can be cold and so empty. And God only knows just how hard I try. I am somebody just like the rest, but you look right through me, even when I give my best. What more can I do after I give my all to you? Do you know me? No, you haven't taken the time. No,
you don't really know me.
No, no. Do I matter to you? Am I only someone you act like you don't see? I wish you believe in me, 'cause I am somebody.
Years ago, a sunken ship was found in the bottom of an Alabama river. It turned out to be the long-lost wreck of the Clotilda, the last slave ship known to have brought captured Africans to America in 1860. At least 12 million Africans were shipped to the Americas in the more than 350 years of the transatlantic slave trade. But as we first reported in November, the journey of the 110 captive men, women, and children brought to Alabama on the Clotilda is one of the best documented slave voyages in history. The names of those enslaved Africans and their story has been passed down through the generations by their descendants, some of whom still live just a few miles from where the ship was found in a community called Africatown. For 160 years, this muddy stretch of the Mobile River has covered up a crime. In July 1860, the Clotilda was towed here under cover of darkness. Imprisoned in its cramped cargo hold, 110 enslaved Africans.
I just imagine myself being on that ship, just listening to the waves and the waters and just not knowing where you were going.
Joyce Lynn Davis, Lorna Gale Woods, and Thomas Griffin are direct descendants of this African man, Oluwale. Enslaved in Alabama, his owner changed his name to Charlie Lewis. This image is from around 1900. Poli Allen, whose African name was Kapoli, seen in this 100-year-old sketch, was the ancestor of Jeremy Ellis and Darren Patterson.
No clothes, eating where they defecated, only allowed out of the cargo hold for one day a week for 2 months. How many people do we know now that could have survived something like that without losing their mind?
There are no photographs of Pat Frazier's great-great-grandmother, Lottie Dennison. But Capriccia Wallace and her mother, Cassandra, have a surprising number of pictures of their ancestor, Kazula, whose owner called him Cudjo Lewis.
What does it feel like to be able to know where you come from, to know the person who came here first?
It's empowering, very. Like, growing up, my mom made sure she told me all the stories that her dad told her about Cudjo.
Cassandra, that was important to you.
Very important.
To pass that knowledge along.
My dad set us down, and he would make us repeat Kazulu, Clotilda, Cudjo Lewis.
It has historical importance as well as a story that needs to be told.
The story of the Clotilda began in 1860 when Timothy Mayer, a wealthy businessman, hired Captain William Foster to illegally smuggle a shipload of captive Africans from the Kingdom of Dahomey in West Africa to Mobile, Alabama. Slavery was still legal in the southern United States, but importing new slaves into America had been outlawed in 1808. In his journal, Captain Foster described purchasing the captives using $9,000 in gold and merchandise. As this replica shows, the enslaved Africans were locked naked in the cargo hold of the Clotilda for two sickening months. When they arrived in Mobile, they were handed over to Timothy Mayer and several others. Captain Foster claimed he then burned and sank the Clotilda, but exactly where remained a mystery. Until 2018, when a local reporter, Ben Raines, found the Clotilda in about 20 feet of water not far from Mobile. He'd been searching for 7 months, following clues in Captain Foster's journal. The exact location hasn't been made public for fear someone might vandalize the ship. But last year, the Alabama Historical Commission gave maritime archaeologist James Delgado, who helped verify the wreck, permission to take us there.
So the Clotilda came up this way?
Straight up here, practically in a straight line after they dropped off the people. And then on one side of the bank, set her on fire and sank her.
So he was trying to destroy evidence of a crime?
Yes.
The bow of the Clotilda is not far from the surface. But the water's so muddy, the only way to see it is with this sonar device.
Sonar's on, zero pressure, good to drop.
So we're almost over now.
Yeah, okay. We're coming right up on it.
So that's the bow right there.
That's it right there?
Right on,
yes.
The bow. Yep.
You can see it like that?
Yeah.
Wow, you can see it totally clearly. I mean, that's the ship.
Yes. Yeah, that's Clotilda.
On sonar, the bow is clearly defined, as are both sides of the hull. The ship is 86 feet long, but the back of it, the stern, is buried deep in mud. Those two horizontal lines are likely the walls of the cargo hold, where the enslaved Africans had been packed tightly together on the voyage from West Africa.
So the hold where people were held, how big was that?
In terms of where people could actually fit, 5 feet by about 20 feet.
Wait a minute, it was only 5 feet high? So people could barely stand up in this hold?
Yes.
Diving on the wreck is difficult. Underwater, there's zero visibility. You can't even see the ship. Delgado's team has only felt it with their hands. They call it archaeology by Braille. This is the only image our camera could pick up, a plank of wood covered with what looks like barnacles. Delgado and state archaeologist Stacy Hathorn showed us some of the artifacts they retrieved. This plank of wood is likely from the hull of the ship. And this iron bolt with wood attached shows evidence of fire damage.
You don't see the grain of the wood.
It basically makes a briquette.
So this is evidence clearly of that they tried to burn the ship?
Yes.
Yes.
The enslaved Africans were taken off the ship before it sank, but Delgado says there could still be DNA from some of them in the wreck.
You will find human hair. You can find nail clippings. Somebody may have lost it, too.
You could still find human hair in the wreck of the Clotilda?
Yes.
The state of Alabama has set aside $1 million for further excavation to determine if the Clotilda can ever be raised from the riverbed. The ship may be too damaged or the effort too expensive.
I think what's extremely important for folks to understand is that there was a concerted effort to hide these things that were done.
Mary Elliott oversees the collection of slavery artifacts at the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington, D.C.
It's important that we found the remnants of this ship because it for African Americans, it's their piece of the true cross, their touchstone, to say, we've been telling you for years, and here's the proof.
Remarkably, many of the descendants still live just a few miles from where the Clotilda was discovered. This is Africatown, founded around 1868, 3 years after emancipation by 30 of the Africans brought on the Clotilda. Joycelyn Davis has organized festivals to honor Africatown's founders, one of whom was her great-great-great-grandfather, Charlie Lewis. Last year, she took us to the street he lived on called Lewis Quarters.
So pretty much everyone on this street can trace their lineage back
yes,
to Charlie Lewis.
Yes, everyone here is related.
Wow.
Yeah.
Lewis and some of the others got jobs at a nearby sawmill owned by Timothy Mayer, the same man responsible for enslaving them.
I mean, they worked for like a dollar a day until they saved up their money to buy land.
Cudjoe Lewis also worked at the Mayer sawmill. This rare film shows him in 1928. By then, he was in his 80s and one of the Clotilda's last living survivors. He helped found this church in Africatown, the same church his descendants still attend today.
After emancipation, it seems so unlikely that a group of freed slaves could pool their resources and build a community. I mean, that's an extraordinary thing.
There's this thing we say about making a way out of no way.
Making a way out of no way.
When these folks were forced over here from the continent of Africa, they didn't come with empty heads. They came with empty hands. So they found a way to make a way, and they relied on each other, and they were resilient.
Africatown is the only surviving community in America founded by Africans, and over the decades, it prospered. There was a business district, the first black school in Mobile, and by the 1960s, 12,000 people lived here.
They built a city within a city, and that's what we can be proud of.
We had a gas station.
Yep.
We had a grocery store,
post office,
yep. All that was a booming area of black-owned business.
But today, those black-owned businesses are gone. An interstate highway was built through the middle of Africatown in the early 1990s, and the small clusters of remaining homes are surrounded by factories and chemical plants. Fewer than 2,000 people still live here. The Smithsonian's Mary Elliott took us to Africatown Cemetery, where some of the Clotilda's survivors and generations of their descendants are buried.
No matter where you go in Africatown, you can hear factories and industry and the highway.
There is this constant buzz here. It's a buzz you hear all the time, day and night. And it's a constant reminder of the breakup of this community.
The descendants we spoke with hope the discovery of the Clotilda will lead to the revitalization of Africatown. And they'd like the descendants of Timothy Mayer, the man who enslaved their ancestors, to get involved. According to tax records, Mayer's descendants still own an estimated 14% of the land in historic Africatown. Their name is on nearby street signs and property markers. Court filings indicate their real estate and timber businesses are worth an estimated $36 million. But so far, the descendants we spoke with say no one from the Mayer family has been willing to meet.
I don't think it's something that people want to remember.
Because they have to acknowledge that they benefit from it today.
That they benefited. That's it. That they benefited. And they don't want to acknowledge
People don't want to look back and acknowledge it.
They don't want to acknowledge that that's how part of their wealth was derived. And that on the backs of those people.
What would you want to say to them? I mean, if they were willing to sit down and have, you know, have a coffee with them.
We would first need to acknowledge what was done in the past.
Yeah.
And then there's an accountability piece that your family for this many years, 5 years, owned my ancestors. And then the third piece would be, how do we partner together with in Africatown?
I don't want to receive anything personally.
Right.
However, there's a need for a lot of development in that community.
We reached out to four members of the Mayer family. All either declined or didn't respond to our request for an interview. One man who did want to meet the descendants is Mike Foster. He's a 74-year-old Air Force veteran from Montana. While researching his genealogy, Mike Foster discovered he's the distant cousin of William Foster, the captain of the Clotilda.
Had you ever heard of the last slave ship?
No. No.
What did you think when you heard it?
I wasn't happy about it. It was very distressing.
Do you feel some guilt?
No, I didn't feel any guilt. I didn't do it. But I could apologize for it.
And last year, before the pandemic, that's exactly what he did.
Yeah, over 160 years have passed, and we finally...
160 years.
Yes.
This is a powerful moment. This is a powerful moment.
So I'm here to say I'm sorry.
Thank you.
That's good.
Thank you.
In an effort to attract tourism to Africa Town, the state of Alabama plans to build a welcome center here. But the descendants we spoke with hope more can be done to restore and rebuild this historic Black community and honor the African men and women who founded it.
So I always think, my God, such strong people, so capable, yeah. Mm-hmm. Achieved so much and started with so little.
We have to do something to make sure that the legacy of those people in that cargo hold never, ever is forgotten, because they are the reason that we're even here.
Since our story first aired, the city of Mobile has broken ground on a museum in Africa Town that will open to the public in the fall.
Coming for you, hear the chains rattle, turn you into a slave, another piece of chattel. Across the seas, stormy waters, show no mercy, she was Satan's daughter, born to steal, bodies to sell. Special place in hell. Matilda's on fire off the Alabama coast. Matilda's on fire. We're still living with a ghost. She took so trip. Her morning song was the crack of a whip. Once who survived died a long time ago. Most of them buried out at Old Plateau. But the pain and the memory will never go away. Her spirit still lives by the shores of the bay. Chained, proud and free. Clotilda.
Special rider she did. Badonkadonk train. I got the blues this morning, they'll last me all day long. I need to find some toast to spread my jelly on. I got 19 women all at once, one more. When I get to one, I'll let the 19 go. Cause I've been hit, baby, by that badonkadonk train. Badonkadonk train is 16 coaches long. Oh, once you get hit, you won't know right from wrong. Oh, mama took my hand and said, don't you ride. But mama couldn't hold me by her side. I ran up the track and got hit by that badonkadonk train. Make a young boy shout, make an old man lose his mind. Make the preacher hug the devil and drink till they both go blind. I stay in trouble all my days. The doctor said they'd kill me if I don't change my ways. But I'm getting hit by that badonkadonk train. I was a little boy, mama kept me by her side. When I saw that train, I knew I was bound to ride. Oh, mama put me out, set out running wild. Daddy said, he ain't no more baby child. That boy been run over by the badonkadonk train. Mama told me, my sisters too, your little girl's gonna be the death of you. She grabbed my hand, she held it tight. I slipped out most every night. I got tore up by that badonkadonk train. Old preacher left the church, throwed his Bible down. Devil came over, picked it off the ground. The devil started shouting, would the train come by? Preacher started jumping till he liked to die. Well, they both got hit by that badonkadonk train. I mean, they both got wore out by that badonkadonk train. Thank you.
Dishes all under the table and threw my hat in the toilet stool. I say she threw all the dishes all under the table and threw my hat in the toilet stool. Love.
know I'm leaving this town. Boy, then I ain't got nothing more to say. Drank hot soft water. She'd take a bath in gasoline. I swear I won't drink no more port wine. Oh, give me another chance, baby. Yeah, if you do, I swear I won't drink no more port wine.
I was born at Thompson, Georgia, down about 134 miles. Born about 9 miles and a half from this little town, between the two creeks, they call it, Little Bry and Big Bry.
A few miles outside Thompson, deep in the farming country of Middle Georgia, the year is 1901, the month of May. He's born blind, and because he will come to know his name by ear, and in the distinct local accent, McTeer will become McTell, so that one day, Willie Samuel McTeer will call himself McTell, Blind Willie McTell. He was an outside child, born out of wedlock to Minnie Watkins, all of 14, and Eddie McTeer, a gambler and moonshiner. A few months after the baby was born, Eddie was gone. Minnie moved a few miles south to the tiny hamlet of Stapleton, keeping the McTeer name for her baby and herself. Country life had drifted along in slow motion through the last decades of the 19th century, but it was motion all the same.
Because freedom was now reality and not a future possibility, many slaves, ex-slaves, left plantations looking for what they thought was their piece of land. Many of them also were looking very, very hard for members of families that had been taken away during that particular period. So there was a great deal of movement throughout the South as people began to seek that particular spot that they wanted to settle upon or to find family and bring them back together again. After the turn of the century, we passed post-Reconstruction, there's a re-intensification of racial oppression in the South in particular. And I say in the South in particular because it was also occurring in the North. And what we begin to find is that the desire for better jobs, more economic opportunity, and a less oppressive social environment was probably the combination that inspired many African Americans to get on the road, to go somewhere else. In that process, you had people for the first time being alone for long periods of time as opposed to having been thrust together as a working body. And so the field holler and call became much more prominent. And an example I can think of is Wild Ox Moan in terms of the lone singer bouncing off him or herself. Why don't you come here, black woman? Sit down on daddy's knee. Mm-hmm. Why don't you come here, black woman? Sit down on daddy's knee. Mm-hmm. And so after a while, you just add your own words, but that mm-hmm is what eventually evolves into what the guitar does. Okay, so when you have an instrumentation, the answer comes from the instrument, not from the voice generally, okay? And so we see that evolution of the singing and the instrumentation becoming one seamless musical activity.
So wrong, just right. Living our best life. We're strong though we cry. Freedom is a lie. Surviving our scars so we can carry on. Giving birth to hope. Drugs make them cold. Wisdom is so old. We don't need
Thank you.
that I'm fine. Yeah, yeah, yeah. All right. Hey, yeah. Did it look well, my dear, to kill you?
Life started keeping me, getting me down. All I could do was smile. Well, I dusted all. Guess I'll keep back up. It was worth the fall. When the times got tough, there's a risk involved. Everything at cost, I make it through. I make it through somehow. Weathered and worn, ever dreaming so wild. All I could do was smile. Well, if you never leave, then your heart won't know. So you take the chance, so you just let go. And you get knocked down, but that's how you grow. All I could do was smile. All I could do was smile. All I could do was smile. There'd be tears in my eyes. All I could do was smile. But I'll make it through. I make it through. I make it through. I make it through somehow. All I can do is smile. Counting on you. Counting on you. Sound. Treasures feel torn, tangled, twisted, and twined. All I can do is smile. All I can do was. All I can do was. All I can do.
I'm
talking about then. That's what I'm saying. Sometimes that's all you can do, and you're going to see why here in a second now. I always like to begin by taking a few breaths together as a way for us to bring our attention to the interconnectivity we share as human beings in these bodies, just simply by breathing. So, all together, just lightly bringing our attention to a breath in, breathing joy, and slowly, lightly releasing out joy. And breathing in joy, feeling it all the way to your toes. And releasing out into this room, lifting every person, joy. And breathing in joy for the last time here consciously in this round. And releasing out joy. Releasing everyone in this world, just lifting them and releasing them from their worries in joy. I am not a historian or a philosopher. I am a poet, an artist, and a musician. And you might think the ideas that I'm about to express seem radical in the face of the pain we as people of color experience. And the pain and the trauma we carry within our lineage. You might even call me a fool for believing in the beauty that I see possible for this world. But since I have been invited to open up to you, here you go. You see, about this time last year, I was in the middle of mixing my new record. I was watching the protest. I was glued to the news as we learned to navigate the coronavirus and this global pandemic. And I was grieving the loss of Representative John Lewis. And in my mind, I saw the picture of this older black woman sitting near the steps of a sharecropping house on the porch. And it seemed that she might be somewhere deep, hot, and dusty down in Mississippi. And it also seemed that maybe she had been a slave, just out of slavery. And maybe she had known the hard times for real. And she sat on that porch, and she was in this beat-up rocking chair, and she was watching her grandchildren run around a no-grass, muddy yard wearing dirty rags with tears rolling down her cheeks. And then she began to smile. Because she had done everything that she could do. As a slave, she had lived on the front lines. She had fought for freedom. And she had tried, you see. And in that moment, all she could do was smile. And in that smile, there was some joy and there was some happiness that just could not be taken from her, no matter what anybody ever did. They could take everything, but they could not take her smile through the setbacks, the brutal beatings, the hosing down, the constant and continuous deeply hostile climate of defeat that she knew her grandchildren would face, and their children, and their children, and their children, and their children's children, all she could do was smile. Because you see, she knew a secret. And that secret was a secret superpower of joy. So once again, breathing in joy and slowly releasing out joy. And it is okay if you allow yourself to gently smile. When we reflect on the visible world, the reality of suffering surrounds us every day. Whether it be our personal suffering or the suffering of others, somewhere at every moment there lives a tragedy. There lives poverty, there lives sickness, heartbreak, racism, hatred, injustice, and loss. Collectively, over the last year of our lives, we have seen some of the deepest and darkest wounds of our nation and across the planet come to the forefront, and the veil has been lifted. And those wounds are wounds that are meant to be healed. From George Floyd saying that I can't breathe, to the coronavirus putting people on ventilators all across the world struggling to breathe, it's clear that our attention needs to be focused on bringing our awareness back to just a simple thing, and that is our breath. So together, we're just going to breathe in joy and slowly release out joy. In watching the news and listening to talks, respectfully, I've heard many of our leaders speak about the need to heal the traumas of our past. And currently, there are movements everywhere focused on educating people about the systemic challenges we as people of color face, the brutal injustices, and the horrors of over 400 years of slavery in our nation. It is a much-needed narrative. And it is a narrative that leaders from Harriet Tubman to Dr. King have told, from the lowest underground to the highest mountaintop. It is a narrative that people have screamed and continue to scream until our voices feel lost, hoarse, sore, and can place no demands. Yes, once again, we have the microphone. We have an opportunity to educate and to grow. And so, is there not a need to tell a story of hope and of joy? Or shall we solely focus on the traumas and the dramas? When we turn on the news or a TV program to be entertained, we often thrive on the violence, the pain, and the fear of different scenes and stories. And I believe there was a time when we needed to be guided by these survival instincts, these barbaric instincts, and an animalistic nature. As the first humans, we needed to be on guard against predators and tribes that might try to bring us harm. But today in our nation, we are living in a sliver of time that might allow us to begin to relate to each other and the world around us on gentler and kinder terms. this time is a time that was given to us by our ancestors' blood, their pain, and their sacrifices. It is a time that they gave as a transformatively powerful window of time for us to learn to rewrite the narrative for the generations to come. And the question is, when and how do we begin to rewrite that narrative? When do we begin to live in the present moment, calling forth those dreams that our ancestors fought and died for? Those dreams that they always wished for us to have. When do we begin to claim the joy and the fortune of our own happiness? One of my favorite writers, Toni Morrison, she said, "You want to fly, you got to give up the thing that weighs you down." Representative John Lewis said, "You have to have the ability to take what people did and how they did it and forgive them and move on." So, why is it important for us to begin to rewrite a new narrative of hope and positivity? I know there is a vulnerability to taking the traumas and the pain and the setbacks of our past and choosing to elevate our minds to a place of a new mindset of positivity and joy. I also know that everything we see in this world was first a thought. There is a magic to an elevated mindset. Just as an alchemist can transform any old metal into gold, so we can transform our traumas into our strengths. Joy is a choice. Positivity is a choice. Joy is a practice. And positivity is a practice. So, all together, if you practice with me, breathing in joy and releasing out joy. Those who are not conscious or familiar with the act of living joyfully often can look at it from the outside and see it as just this happy or easy thing to do. But to witness the daily injustices of laws that systemically work to the detriment of people of color and to shift our gaze forward by choosing a path of radical joy is one of the most fierce and dangerous risks we can ever take. It is to live in a mindset of a dream, similar to Dr. King's dream. It is to live in a mindset of the change we wish to see. As Gandhi said, be the change you wish to see. And it is to live in a world of wonder and imagination, all the while being inundated with the daily societal oppression. Yes, there is a magic to mindset, and it is moving from the idea that we shall overcome to truly claiming and speaking into the being the idea that we have now overcome. It is calling it forth and making that our present moment. So how do we transform the pain of this present moment? Well, when we look at the sky on a cloudy day, there's gray clouds and it's very blurry, and we might be deep in the shadows of our life. But we know that somewhere up there above the clouds, the sun and the stars are still shining. And whenever we reach the darkness of night, and this can be the darkest time of our life, we know that the sun is starting to rise somewhere on the other side of the planet. It has been said that we create our own reality based on the way our mind is focused. There is a magic to an elevated mindset. In telling our stories, in our narratives, in our lectures, in our songs, if we choose to continue only focusing on pain, then I have to ask, are we recreating the same cycles of history again and again? How can we utilize our inner joy to own a new narrative and to begin to mold a brighter future? The resilience that is found in mindful living is something that can never be taken from us, no matter what obstacles we might face in our lives. No one can take it. Toni Morrison, like I said, favorite writer. She said, freeing yourself is one thing, but claiming ownership of that freed self was another. Today is the day that we claim ownership of that freed self through the practice of joy. Now is the time to be joyful in this world of darkness. Yes, it carries substantial risk. It requires being vulnerable. But I believe that after the darkness that we have endured, it is beyond time for us to give ourselves a chance to focus on the light. I want to ask the question of white America. In the way of highlighting our writers, our most popular black writers, they are writers who have written about our pain. And in our films, most of our films, aside from Black Panther, which I freaking loved, because it showed us in a light. Most of our films are highlighting the trauma. And so are you ready to celebrate Black joy? And I want to ask the question of people of color. Are you ready to fucking shine and live in Black joy and celebrate your life? We have a heavy past, but we also have a choice of today choosing a new narrative for our children and their children and their children and their children's children. I'm sorry I cussed. I got a cussing problem, man. I'm a total hippie. I'm all about all the peace and love, but I love cussing. Well, I also want to ask if we are ready for individual healing, for communal healing, and for familial healing. And if we are, then if we just focus on the four walls of our home or this inside body, and we trust that our neighbor has that same focused intention, and that same focused intention in a very small sphere upon very small sphere upon very small sphere all throughout the planet, then we will begin to see an elevated earth. It is time. Well, I know it's hard, and it can be hard for us to soften into our joy. But it's okay to realize that the revolution can be joyful. The revolution can be mindful. The revolution can be multiracial, multigender, multi-class. We are living in a very fortunate time. We're living in a very unique time where we can ask these tough questions. We can breathe together and we can ask these questions because our ancestors carved this time for us to do it. And we can also collectively have a desire to actualize substantial change as we begin to sculpt a more egalitarian society. I believe in us. Representative John Lewis said, "Get in good trouble, necessary trouble, and help redeem the soul of America." I have faith that our community can do what is necessary to grow. But with the third charge there of redeeming the soul of America,